It's election season, everyone. Doesn't get much more exciting than this, even in the minefield. But there hasn't really been much excitement so far, so we'll try to find some other way of tackling it, I guess. Here we are, trying to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. And I, Waleed Ali, am just champing at the bit to try to figure out how we can get stuck into this election where nothing much is quite happening. Yet here is Scott Stevens, my co-host.
Yes, indeed. Well, we found a fairly creative way. But you know, Waleed, before we, before we launch in, and look, it wasn't out of desperation. It's actually something more like moral, you know, commitment and attention. But before we launch in, I just wanted to acknowledge, I mean, you've had a pretty big 4 days since Logie's night, and you know, far be it from us to sort of join this seemingly endless throng of congratulations. And you know, you must be sick of the, what is it, up to now 20,000 selfies or something that you've had to take, and you know, put up with fans dropping rose petals at your feet as you walk. We don't want to sort of indulge in anything like that, but you know, buddy, if you'll just permit me a little bit of fraternal pride,
hang on.
Anybody, I know you hate compliments, so you're just going to sit there and take it, or the producer's going to turn your mic off. And anybody who has listened to you for more than 5 seconds is struck by your prodigious intelligence. Everybody knows that. Just simply going by the sheer extent of your contribution to our public life, most people would have to be, you know, even reluctantly admit that you're a great man. But what people saw on Sunday night, I think, was that you're also a good one. And there was something about, buddy, your effortless humility, the unfeigned love that you expressed for your wife and for your colleagues. It just, well, let me just say, it made us incredibly proud of you. So, yes, congratulations, buddy, and we are very thankful for you.
Well, it's incredibly kind of you to say. Are we on air? Is this happening? Or like, I feel like we're having an off-air conversation at the moment, and I don't quite know how to respond
now,
to it.
Well, don't respond.
I'll just express my gratitude with what you've just said. Thank you. That's very kind of you. If I'd had any idea you were about to mention this, I would not have turned up today.
That's why we kept that little bit secret. Anyway, yeah, right, launching into the task at hand, it is election season. It's this kind of strange convergence of political streams, isn't it? I mean, the election campaign here has just kicked off, just as the presidential primaries in the U.S. have reached, it seems to me, their denouement. So this is peak season for political journalism. But, you know, on this show, we like mixing things up a little and taking the usual wisdom and standing it on its head. So here's what we wanted to talk about today. What is the moral responsibility, not of politicians? I think we talk about that quite a lot. But what are the moral responsibilities of political journalists? This used to be a very common and very commonly asked and reflected upon question, little more than, say, 3-4 decades ago. These days, it seems to have receded a bit from our public conversation. So I thought, what a nice time to bring it back again. And I suspect, Waleed, it's a bit of a trickier question to answer then it first strikes the eye. So set us off. What do you think? What's your gut-level reaction?
You're right, that's a complicated question because it's iterative, really, isn't it? The way that journalism is meant to deal with politics depends a little bit on how politicians deal with journalists and the public and how they set up the political game, and that in turn depends a bit on the way that the public responds to things and the way that media reports them. And so one of the wicked problems, I guess, with this, and I think you could actually mount this as a critique of the way that media works generally, but one of the wicked problems with this whole system is that everybody can always find somebody else to point to as the source of the moral collapse in any kind of system like this. So if I have to think about what it is that journalism is meant to do in the context of a democracy, I'd probably say it's to lubricate the cannons of democracy or lubricate the engines of democracy, because between voters and politicians, there is a gulf. And voters are incapable, really, of exercising their civic duty in any remotely serious way if there is not some means by which they can access politics. And so I feel, as someone who occasionally has to sit down and interview a prime minister or a minister or something like that, that really what I am is a stand-in for all those people who can't be in that position and yet who need the information that is about to come out of it. But that's a really simple, asinine description of it, Scott, as you would know, because it gets complicated by the fact that politicians will play us, and then we will play politicians. And so there, I think what that's set up is a kind of adversarial system. which is complicated, I think, for the way that democracy is meant to work. But I'm going to come up front and say I don't really, at the moment, see a way out of it.
Mm. And look, I actually think that's a perfectly respectable and defensible position that you've put forward. And I mean, you're actually in the position, so far be it from me to naysay you. But I think, Waleed, it is worth pointing out that the way that you just described it, this actually is a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, we can actually date this quite precisely to around 1967, 1968, when the media went from being something that was more or less continuous with the development of the popular press from the mid-19th century until the mid sort of 1960s. And the media took on a kind of life of its own. It almost became a sort of counter power. It became an oppositional force over and against the professionalization of Western politics. And you can see very clearly from the early 1970s that the extent of the journalist's responsibility was to hold power to account, to almost position itself over and against politicians. And the way you began the conversation was exactly right. It created this iterative death roll where one side wants to expose the other and the other side is trying to defend itself from being unnecessarily embarrassed. What I'd like to
More than that, it's trying to use a platform to send very carefully manicured messages.
Yes, yes.
That's the big thing that has changed, I think.
Yes, and in fact, again, talking about very specific dates, you can plot this. It was in 1964 that the first batch... Oh, sorry, 1964 that the first batch of Madison Avenue ad executives were ushered into the corridors of power in Washington, precisely in order to be able to manicure the message, to be able to communicate in a very controlled way with the people. Here's what I want to suggest to you, Waleed, is that there is another way of thinking about the journalist's responsibility, so that the political journalist isn't so much in this antagonistic or oppositional relationship to the politician, but rather the political journalist serves a deeper conception of one's own political tradition, if we looked behind ourselves, and some more substantive goal that even the politicians themselves ought to be pursuing. If you'll allow me a little bit of historical nostalgia, I want to treat you to one of the greatest bits of modern political journalism. This is from 1954. This is Edward R. Murrow concluding a CBS broadcast about the allure of McCarthyism.
We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
That's American broadcaster Edward R. Murrow in 1954. I want you to notice just two quick things, Waleed. Firstly, do you notice the way that Murrow, he doesn't debase the political functions of government. He actually, you know, holds out a kind of hopefulness about both the American political vision and also even the functions of Senate inquiries. But the other thing that he does is it's not just all finger-pointing at McCarthy. He's also implicating the American people themselves in a common betrayal of some common good. It seems to me that's a far cry from often the sort of sharply critical or even self-righteous type of political commentary we often hear today.
Yep, I think that's fair enough to observe. But I think, I don't know, if you want to zoom out enough, we've discussed this a lot, Scott. Doesn't that just mirror the developments of the way that social ethics are kind of devolving? Right? That everyone's really seeking to appropriate capital for their purposes. And for journalists at the moment, part of that capital is to have won a contest, particularly with a politician. And for politicians, it's to have got a message out there that will work in a particular focus grouped kind of way. Everyone has their own ends that they're pushing towards. I'm a little unsure, though, that the idea of the media as a source of power and something that's effectively a counterbalance to other forms of power is entirely a new idea. If it was Edmund Burke that spoke about the Fourth Estate, Scott, I'm not entirely sure what he meant if it didn't mean that there was a source of power that was in some way countervailing. Now, you might be right to say that that was tethered to some greater conception of the common good or some greater existential purpose. But you might be right to say that, and that would not be an unfamiliar theme in our conversations. But it's not to say that there was no power at all. And indeed, one of the things I think that's interesting about modern journalism is the way that it reflexively wants to gesture towards neutrality, that newspapers pretend in some way that they're being neutral, although that's starting to fall away. Mm. Once upon a time, newspapers were radical advocacy instruments. That's what they were. That's the way that newspapers positioned themselves. They were forthright. They were effectively journals of opinion before they were journals of fact. And I think we can overlook that. I think we can overlook how full-throated some of our journalistic history has been. Mm. But anyway, who knows? What do I know about journalistic history? We're about to meet someone who knows a lot more about it than I do because they've lived a lot of it. You're listening to The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website. Search for RN The Minefield. You can also tweet us at RN The Minefield. But before you do that, just take a listen to this. We're going to go back a couple of years. Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister. I don't know, maybe it was only a couple of weeks. It feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? He was a guest of Kerry O'Brien. Oh, no, it was a couple of years ago. This was on the 7:30 Reporter. Remember this exchange?
Mr. Rudd, when the opposition tried to argue with you on holding back a vote on the ETS until after Copenhagen, that is, until after the world had made a stand, you said that was absolute political cowardice. So why is it not now absolute political cowardice for you to show leadership on this to the rest of the world by seeking to take the Australian people with you at the next election on an ETS?
You know something, Kerry, where I think you've got this fundamentally wrong is, frankly, being absent from the negotiations in Copenhagen themselves. There was no government in the world, like the Australian government, which threw its every energy at bringing about a deal, a global deal on climate change. Penny Wong and I sat up for 3 days and three nights with 20 leaders from around the world to try and frame a global agreement. Now, it might be easy for you to sit and 7:30 report land and say that was easy to do. Let me tell you, mate, it wasn't.
It was Kevin Rudd back in 2010, not at all happy with the line of questioning pursued by Kerry O'Brien, suggesting that he had actually squibbed his dedication to climate change by shelving the planned ETS. Now, at the time, I'm sure you remember, this was actually reported as Prime Minister loses cool with host of 7:30. But I wonder, I mean, you know, we've had a fair bit to say about Kevin Rudd on this program, and we've both written about him, but he actually had a point. Didn't he? I mean, he actually had, I think, a thoroughly credible point to be made. Well, let's ask someone about that. Among the pantheon of political journalists in this country, they don't actually come quite as eminent as Paul Bongiorno. He's national affairs editor with Network 10, and we're absolutely thrilled, despite, you know, Waleed's snarky little reference to your advanced age, Paul.
Oh, hang on, that's not fair.
What? That Paul's been around to actually observe most of modern political history. I mean, gee whiz.
Oh, Paul is modern political history.
I'd like to think that wisdom comes with old age.
So, Paul, let me just put this to you. I mean, the former Prime Minister had a point that it's actually easy for journalists to sit back in the cheap seats and snark from the sidelines, where it's Prime Ministers who are in the room and who will be judged dramatically by history and by the electorate.
Well, I guess there are participants and actors. Journalists are definitely participants in the dynamics of a democracy, of a free society, but they're basically participating in the actions of the politicians and the prime ministers. So Kevin Rudd would have been a lot better off actually answering Kerry O'Brien's charge there than charging Kerry O'Brien with sitting back and being an armchair critic.
Yeah, because that's the thing, Scott. Wasn't Kerry O'Brien's question actually perfectly formed?
Of course it was. Of course.
He's asking a question about the moral seriousness of the case that Kevin Rudd's putting. And if Kevin Rudd's response is to say, mate, you weren't there, you don't know what goes on, well, that's all true, but it's actually beside the point.
But no, it was more than that. It's you weren't there, you weren't responsible for the negotiations, and you don't appreciate how difficult this is to achieve. I think that's the added little dimension there. It's the agency, and it's also the accountability. Who's going to hold a journalist accountable.
I disagree with your reading of that exchange. Ooh. I don't know, Bond, what you think, but I feel like what Kevin Rudd was saying, sorry, the question that Kerry O'Brien was putting to him is not so much why did you fail to get an agreement, but why is it that the agreement is now the precondition for us doing something? When previously that was no precondition at all. And so that's what I think. I don't know. To what extent, Bonge, can we sort of say the journalist is really morally bound to ask this kind of question as opposed to that kind of question? Because I suspect that was Kevin Rudd's objection.
Well, maybe, but I think the journalist's responsibility is to seek out of the elected Prime Minister if he failed, why he failed, and if it is difficult, what was difficult about it, and what are you then going to do about it? Myself as the interviewer or the journalist, that is my role. My role wasn't to be a delegate at a conference or to resolve a problem. My role was to expose the problem and see what the actors dealing with the problem are doing about it.
Hmm. Now, let me just go all Aristotelian on you both, though.
All right.
It was bound to happen.
I
suggest that what... You see, Paul's at home now. He's flicking right now through his Summa Theologicae. He's been brushing up on his Thomas Aquinas. He's been training
ready
for this.
To go.
Here we go. So I suspect that what we're talking about is, if you like, a penultimate good. I'm not suggesting for a second that the line of questioning that Kerry O'Brien was pursuing there, or the lines of even adversarial questioning that modern journalists to contemporary prime ministers pursue, I'm not saying that either of those are bad things. The point is they are penultimate goods. They are not the final good. They're not what journalism as such ought to be aiming for. So here's my question to you both. I would suggest that the electorate is probably more literate about political strategy, about political dealings, about political machinations than they ever have been before. That's a penultimate good. The final good, what final good is that serving? I mean, it seems as though that this increased insider knowledge is doing little more than debasing our confidence, our hopefulness in democracy as such. Is there some final good that we ought to be serving?
Well, yeah, of course, the final good that we all serve is what we call the national interest or the advancement of humankind, or happiness. There's various philosophical discussions about what we're on Earth for and what society wants to achieve and how it achieves it. But basically, what we're trying to achieve is a common good.
Yeah, it's an interesting question that you ask, and I think it gets thrown into sharp relief in the way that in this current campaign, we're seeing media leap really quite energetically on anything that might resemble a gaffe.
Yes.
So that I think is the danger of what you point to in the adversarial system. I, as someone with legal training, quite like adversarial systems as a way of trying to get to the nub of things, right? That if you can put alternative arguments in their best forms, then what we can do is maybe come to some kind of reconciliation or some kind of decision about things. I suspect what you're pointing to is that modern journalism is calibrated not to put arguments in their best forms so much as to try to get something that will then be embarrassing. And that once it's embarrassing, then the ultimate good is lost and only the penultimate good is served.
But I think we can't have this conversation, as it were, in the sphere of Platonic ideas. We have to bring it right down to reality. We have to put it into the context that the media does not exist in a vacuum. The media exists concretely, and it exists in different forms. For example, there's the commercial media that only survives if people watch it or listen to it and take notice of the people who are advertising. And the people who advertise only advertise because there are so many ears or eyeballs attracted to it. Therefore, the media has a role of informing through entertainment. Marshall McLuhan didn't mind that. He thought that people were best informed by being entertained. Therefore, the project act is a huge success in McLuhan's view, and therefore morally serving a moral purpose. Then we have even over on the ABC, which doesn't have a commercial master, as it were, but it then has to serve the truth or the reality of our free society. And if the people who are leading it or seeking to leading it are in touch with our reality and our values.
Excellent. Excellent. Let me ground this one step further, though. I would suggest to you both that it's a fundamental mistake to pit media and politicians against each other. Instead, both of them ought to be oriented towards something in common, a kind of third point, rather than simply at each other. So, if you would grant my proposition that that part of the media's role, even if it's through exposing scandal, even if it's through holding prime ministers and politicians and public figures to account, that the media's fundamental goal has to involve sustaining a hopefulness in our common life, a hopefulness in our democratic process. Does that mean that a journalist is ethically bound not to report, say, a trivial or an embarrassing political story that would needlessly debase our faith, our confidence in the political process itself?
So I would say to that yes, I would agree with you on that. But a lot of work is being done by words such as needless and trivial.
It's true. It's true.
Right. And then that then becomes the site of argument. But generally speaking, I would agree with that proposition. Bond, I think what's interesting about what you said, particularly in the case of commercial news, is what if we were able to conceive of, as I understand did happen in the United States originally, what if we were able to conceive of news being something that was carved out of commercial broadcasting as being free from advertisement? That is, it was the price that you paid for the license that you got to broadcast and was thereby freed from commercial imperatives, and then you could make decisions of the kind Scott's talking about.
Well, theoretically, that's happening in Australia, although what we've seen is the regulation of the commercial media. Like, for example, a condition of, say, Channel 10's license is the way in which it does its journalism. There are legal obligations on the commercial telecasters, for example, that aren't on the newspapers, even though both the newspapers and the commercial telecasters are trying to attract advertisers. Theoretically, and maybe if you cast your mind back to the stories about Kerry Packer and tax evasion and all of that, one of the great things was that Channel 9 News reported that. But one does begin to fear that as the decades have moved on, that vested interests that buy into commercial media do so with the purpose of pushing their barrow rather than allowing journalists to be unfettered in the pursuit of serving the democratic polity.
Yeah, but see, this is where I wonder if those commercial interests, they actually might be dwarfed by another imperative. I mean, it's the subtle assumption of almost every newsroom in the world at the moment that the goal of a particular story is to go viral. Because of that, that imposes a different sort of economy, if you like, on the sorts of things that are deemed newsworthy. So, you know, it wasn't that long ago when, as principled and editorially serious a newspaper as the Huffington Post said that it wasn't going to cover anything about Trump except in its entertainment section. Now, that crumbled almost immediately. And then you have, because Trump is a lightning rod for clicks, then you have virtually anything that he is saying being reported and reproduced. I mean, surely journalistic morality, a sense of the preservation of the common good, has to click in at some point where you say, no, I will not reproduce this, even if it's going to attract a colossal audience.
Well, but Paul, we only have about a minute, but I was wondering if you could answer that with reference to whether or not you think that's gotten worse, that kind of judgment.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's more pervasive, there's no doubt about it, but don't also forget that we do need to have a sense of humour, and there are various different mediums that are open to journalists. There is sheer entertainment, and that's where someone like a Trump can be a godsend, and then there are the real issues that have to be dealt with, and that's where he gets very scary.
And where it becomes tricky, because treating him as entertainment can then feed into those bigger issues, and there's an interrelationship between those two things. So it is very complicated, and we don't have time to discuss it properly because we're in the media and we're on deadlines. So bad luck, everyone. Paul, it's been wonderful to have you on our show. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Waleed, and thank you, Scott.
Paul Wondorano, National Affairs Editor with Network 10.
Yes, and we'd love to hear what you think. You can leave us a comment. Just search for us at RN The Minefield. You can also follow us on Twitter at RN The Minefield.
See you next week.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.